Because you knew I could do those things that you weren't capable of doing. Well, it worked. And you'll get what you want. A war between the Romulans and the Dominion. And if your conscience is bothering you, you should soothe it with the knowledge that you may have just saved the entire Alpha Quadrant, and all it cost was the life of one Romulan senator, one criminal, and the self-respect of one Starfleet officer. I don't know about you, but I'd call that a bargain.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton speaking directly into the camera. You know what I'm talking about.
We're going dark tonight. Yeah.
So, Cam, what exactly are we tackling this week?
We are going to talk about when Star Trek goes dark.
Yeah. So I think we wanted to find this outright, though. And I alluded to it last week when we were pitching kind of the idea for this one. But I think a lot of it has to do with a lot of the moral compromise that we would witness in a series that's all about the best of humanity and about humanity making decisions that are, I guess, not so much socialistic, but altruistic here. And I think when we see that humanity still has some very dark threads going on in it, I think that's where Star Trek can get interesting, even though it may bother a lot of viewers, but it does play with our expectations. And I think it's worth bringing up here. And I mean, we may actually kind of disagree about whether or not something fits in our own definition. I think a lot of listeners will as well, but I think this will be a very interesting conversation that we can have about what it means for Star Trek to go dark and how well they justify these adventures that we go on the crew that makes us feel a little icky inside.
Right. And I'll say that not all of mine touch on sort of the decisions of your crew. I look at, in at least a few of the cases, as you know, science fiction offers metaphors for humanity, and that's what Star Trek does best. So some of mine will talk a little bit about, like, aliens of the week and some of the episodes that really went to very dark places that reflect human failings, essentially. Okay. And how these episodes, every one I think I'm going to name on my list is an episode that when it was over, I was just like, whew, like that was rough.
Yeah. One of the issues that I think both you and I had is like, okay, is Deep Space Nine going to dominate everything here?
Sure, yeah.
I think maybe towards the end of the episode, we can name check a bunch of adventures that were like, okay, Deep Space Nine went dark here, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But essentially, we kind of want to stick to maybe one choice per series each and then go from there. But I think we need to get this big one out of the way. I think that's what everybody's going to be expecting. But let's talk a little bit about In the Pale Moonlight.
Right.
And this, of course, is what I was referring to at the start of the episode, staring directly into the camera. But this, of course, is where we see essentially Sisko not only eschew the values of the Federation by being complicit in criminal activity, but he looks up to the camera and says, I can live with that.
Right.
He is not apologizing for his actions here. He is in the ends justify the means, because otherwise, and they're just doing the math here, the Federation is going to lose the war. So to me, I can't tell you, like, after this episode aired, like, I can only speak for, like, the Trek BBS that I was on at the time, people went ballistic over whether or not this is a great exceptional drama, or whether or not this was, I guess, jumping the shark to a certain degree.
Right, or like a betrayal of what Roddenberry had established.
Yeah, yeah. You can be sure that
I'm curious, was there any sort of rough percentage you saw in the types of reactions it got?
I think people are actually more favorable towards it because it was so different than anything we'd really seen from Star Trek before. We've seen characters do dark actions before, but there was a sense of repentance, you know, this sense that, you know, that they felt, you know, compromised or bad about what they did. Sisko did no such thing. And I think this The key to this one, though, is Garrick.
Yeah.
And of course, you can say, well, yeah, obviously, he's kind of like this former spy. But it's really Garrick articulating a lot of the arguments and justifying for Sisko in his own brain. And I think that's one of the most insidious things that can ever happen. Because Sisko, as soon as Sisko finds out that Garrick bombed that Romulan senator's ship, he goes and starts beating the crap out of him. And Garrick's like, all it took to save the entire Federation was the death of one senator. Right. How's about that there? And I think that's where Sisko's like, yeah, well, I guess I can live with that. But your viewing of this, I mean, I'm sure you heard about this episode long before you ever saw it.
Yeah.
Was it built up too much?
By you?
By me before you ever saw it, though?
Like, in the sense that it disappointed me? Or in the sense, as like, well, that you set it up as a like standout episode?
Maybe in all senses, though, because that was my biggest fear, though, is because this episode is so different from any other episode of Star Trek that I had seen up until that point, that it really did shake me and shock me. But as much as it compromised maybe the vision of Gene Roddenberry, I think this is ultimately something that would take place within this universe, and I can buy it, even though it's happening with our main character, who shouldn't be up to this sort of stuff. To me, it was a genuinely kind of mind-altering like adventure to follow right. on Deep Space Nine. But I'm wondering if I had just kind of built that up too much to you, and then you're expecting something big to happen. You knew other fans had talked a lot about this, and so, and you'd already seen many a year of other TV series like Breaking Bad or whatever.
Sure, X-Files. You know, I've seen a lot of dark TV episodes, yeah. right? So, yeah. I think, first off, this episode was not oversold to me in terms of its quality. Like, I was wowed by this episode and where it was taking its characters. Like, the Dominion War stuff, you know, was just so fantastically written. Like, I was so swept up in the series that this episode just continued the acceleration of the excitement for me. I will say, I don't know that it jumped out at me as much as like an episode that really just shook the concepts of Star Trek to its core or anything. Okay. And I do wonder if that has a little bit to do with the fact that I watched TOS first and then I went right into DS9.
Okay.
I feel like I think this episode might have hit harder if I had been, like a lot of people, a diehard TNG watcher.
Which seemed to be a show, I referenced Moral Compromise earlier. Mm-hmm. This TNG seemed very much to be a morally uncompromising show in right. which this is right, this is wrong.
Yes.
There really shouldn't be any shades of gray here. And we're yeah. it is didactic to a certain degree.
Oh, there was some shades of gray.
awkward. Why did I bring that up? But yeah, so I think maybe that plays a big part into like your own viewing experience, because I think
right.
just among mainstream Trek fans, TNG is the go-to series.
Definitely.
Right? And I think yeah. that's maybe a bit of like their touchstone series. And so when you see something that really goes against the Gene Roddenberry vision, so
not
obviously,
just the Gene Roddenberry vision, the Picard vision.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is a big part of it too, is that Picard, for so many fans, is just like this beacon of optimism. You know, you go to a convention and like the amount of attention shown towards Patrick Stewart is just through the roof. Like, he means so much to the audiences, and Picard, of course, by extension, that I can totally see how an episode like this, where a captain is making these sorts of decisions and being like, yeah, I can live with this, that would wound them to a certain degree, I mm-hmm. think. Because the universe of Star Trek, for a lot of these people, exists with TNG onwards. It doesn't kind of wrap into kind of the loopier TOS era.
Mm-hmm.
So I completely understand. Okay. But as someone who came on board before watching TNG all the way through, it didn't have that sort of, I think, like that bombshell effect on me.
So maybe a question we should be asking ourselves as we go through episode by episode is whether this, you know, compromises Star Trek to a certain degree, or mm-hmm. whether it functions within the universe, whether this is something that you could buy happening within the universe that's been established here.
Right.
So, Cam, why don't we throw it over to you? I'll let you pick an episode, any episode you wish from one of the series. I'm so used to saying five series, it's six series now.
Right. Okay, well, you know, we were talking about TNG. Why don't I just give my TNG pick now? I struggled with TNG quite a bit.
Okay.
There's episodes that fall under, like, for me, dark and kind of depressing in a way that doesn't necessarily reflect on character decisions. Mm-hmm. Like, I look at, like, the episode Phantasms, which is very nightmarish and has, of course, Troy getting stabbed in a turbo lift. that's bleak, dark, like nightmarish stuff. But the episode I ended up going with was Chain of Command Part 2.
Okay.
Which is, of course, the famous episode where Picard is being tortured by Galma Dread. And, you know, we've seen characters be tortured on other episodes of Star Trek. I'd seen it this point in time on, like, Firefly. It's not outside the norm. But there's something about this that has a heaviness to it that is so unsettling and weighty. And I think a lot of it has to do with the character of Galma Dread, and that, you know, he has his daughters coming into this scene. And there's something just so awful about it, well, but also very mundane about the evil.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the, I remember I was in Hungary, in Budapest, and there was this war memorial, and they're talking about how just the entire banality of just the war atrocities that took place. And I think that's kind of reflected very much in Madrid's attitude. And yeah, if you weren't going to bring her up, the fact that he brought his daughter in there, that's something that I thought was very key to this. But when we did our episode review of Chain of Command Parts 1 and 2, the thing that you and I kind of, you know, really seized on was that there's like this spiritual battle going on between Picard and Madrid that is just punishing to watch. This is an episode that will really drain you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When, you know, I did some research into the production on this episode, and like Patrick Stewart prepared for this episode and these torture scenes by watching tapes that were provided by Amnesty International. So, like, what kind of stuff was he watching just to get into the mindset of this episode? And I think whatever he was doing, whatever he was watching, he carries that mood into those scenes. Like, he feels broken and just destroyed by this experience in a way that stands outside of any other experience I can think of in a movie or TV show of a character in sort of a franchise kind of property. You know, when we get to darker dramas, maybe so. But in terms of like a franchise, a known franchise, I've never seen anything like this.
Now, do you think if, you know, I keep hating to go back to saying like the Gene Roddenberry vision.
Yeah.
If Gene Roddenberry was around, would this episode have existed as well? I can see him doing it in the TOS era.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about the TNG era, where his storytelling really had changed to a degree that, well, I mean, a lot of it was just wasn't recognizable compared with what we saw in TOS.
And I don't know that he would have included a scene like Galma Dread bringing in his daughter. I don't think he would have. I think it's reaching a level of uncomfortable that I don't know if he would have been willing to quite go there.
That said, I mean, this is something that I totally buy happening within the universe that has been established already on The Next Generation. The other thing I think is pretty fantastic here, or at least like very redeemable, is that Picard doesn't seem to lose by the end of it. Like he comes very close to giving in.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, he prevails right up to the last minute, though. And you just see the look that those other Cardassian commanders had when they walked in on Madrid doing this garbage to Picard.
Yeah.
And that's when you know Madrid's lost it. And when the enemy is looking at their peers and judging them so harshly.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like, this is, I think, TNG's heaviest hour of television.
It is heavy.
Yeah.
But for me, with my TNG pick, I'm going to go to one, like, I've mentioned it before as one of my favorite TNG episodes, but I didn't really like it the first time I saw it. And I think as I got older, I appreciate this more and more, but I go back into that moral compromise. And I think I've never seen Picard so morally compromised as I did in The Perfect Mate.
Right.
This is where he takes Kamala, the alien, under his care after she's, I guess, prematurely hatched. Is that an appropriate term?
I'll go with it.
Sure. But she's meant to be this perfect mate, and he has to take her under his care. The problem is she's designed to be Picard's perfect mate just through the sheer accident, because she encountered him and first out of anyone because of this premature hatching. And they leave it open to interpretation by the end of the episode, where her real caretaker says, "Picard, I want to thank you so much for taking care of her. I don't know how you're able to resist her charms."
Yeah.
And there's a look on Patrick Stewart's face, and he just kind of storms out of the transporter room ever so subtly. You realize, oh my God, Picard's actually completely failed in his duties in a way that we've never seen before. And like, he does completely violate his obligations as a Starfleet officer. And I know this doesn't stand out as like a depraved episode where right. there's torturing, there's stabbings or anything like that. But I think this is very dark in terms of the moral compromise of a character who prided himself on always taking the moral high ground, but he really could not resist. And it speaks to kind of, I guess, the power of sexuality, especially within Picard's own life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not the go-to episode for when people think dark TNG, but to me, I think this there's a good argument to be made here.
I think it's interesting that you picked this episode because I think it is so centered on the character involved. Because, you know, how does this episode play? Just from the point of view of, like, how would the writers present this material if it was Riker in the story?
Or Worf or Geordi.
Yeah.
I don't think you would have left this episode feeling as uncertain about a character that you've been so invested in, about their own moral fortitude to agree. I think that's a very good point, because he seems morally compromised at the end, and I think it's because he's always held him up to such high standards. And I think a lot of viewers can watch this episode and interpret it one way, like, oh yeah, hey Picard,
yeah,
you've got a lot of resilience right there. I think what Patrick Stewart is clearly going for with his performance is that he failed utterly in his duties, and he gave in to lust, essentially. But how could he really resist that from a woman who is designed to do such a thing?
Not only that, but a captain's life, we've seen, is very lonely.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can understand how he's that much more vulnerable. But another thing about Picard is, like, I 100% believe that Picard carries his mistakes with him a lot. Mm. Like, more so maybe than any other character.
Yeah, I
maybe Worf to a certain degree, but I mean,
do you think Sisko's the one who shrugs him off most easily?
Probably.
Yeah, okay.
But who do you think is on TNG?
Who shrugs off their mistakes?
Yeah.
Just the lack of emotions, maybe Data?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe, yeah.
I think Geordi gets haunted a lot by his mistakes, though.
The dark of night, yes.
Dark of the holodeck. or perhaps Barclay does as well.
Oh, Barclay's another one. Barclay and Picard should actually have some talks. I feel like Picard would have a similar sense. Like, he's not someone who's going to demonstrate to people that he's bothered by these things as much. He's much more insular in his, you know, how he displays his emotions. But I totally believe that these episodes, whether it's, you know, The Perfect Mate or Chain of Command, like, these things stick with him in a big, bad way.
Yeah. Okay. What's the next episode you've got here?
Okay, well, let's just jump over to TOS. TOS is a tough one because I don't feel like there's a lot of episodes that really kind of bring the characters to their breaking points in a way that the other series do.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up going, I did consider A City on the Edge of Forever for the decision of letting Edith Keeler die or not. But I ended up going with one that I think is actually much grimmer, just for what it's saying at the time about humankind. And the way I look at it nowadays, it feels even heavier. And that's the episode, Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. And this is the episode, the one that I think a lot of people look at as kitschy, where it's the two aliens arrive on the ship, black on one side, white on the other, and, you know, it's reversed on the two sides. And the two aliens are fighting the whole time because of how their colors are opposite of each other. And it's the sort of thing that feels very on the nose. It feels very kitschy. But it's what this episode says, and that these characters cannot get on the same page at all throughout the episode, and ultimately are taken back to their planet, which has been bombed into basically Armageddon through Civil War. And these two aliens basically just are dropped off to pursue each other until, I guess, they, you know, kill each other or whatever on an empty planet, and the ship just kind of takes away. And I think it is so depressing as to what it says at the time, because this, you know, this is season three. Fred Freiberger era, which, not known as the best era, but, you know, he said this was one of his favorite episodes.
But it kind of goes against what we assume the Federation was all about, though.
It is, but there's something about what it's saying about humanity, and that humanity is, you know, it's hatred. And you think of 1968, this is right during the Civil Rights era, which is, there's obviously a lot of terrible, terrible things going on. And just like that pessimism that exists. And I look at it in this point of view, like the modern context, where a lot of the time it feels very hopeless.
Right.
And I look at this episode and I go, like, it's sort of speaking to the pessimism you would feel during these times of strife. And, like, that these aren't going to get solved. It's only going to get worse. just mutually assured destruction.
Yeah.
And so is that the Star Trek way? No. You know, I think Star Trek likes to be more optimistic than this. But it's sort of showing that human weakness, that feeling of like, oh my God, we're just, it's never going to get better.
It's not one of those typical Kirk episodes where he teaches a species all about the meaning of love.
Right.
And you're like, oh, okay, I walk away feeling better about this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like they fail in their mission, essentially.
Yeah, which doesn't, I think, happens too infrequently on Star Trek in that virtually every mission is a success in one way or another, which to me, I'm more about the adventure versus the destination.
Right.
But in this situation, this is a bit of an outlier here.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, okay, I wasn't planning on it, but I'll stick with TOS as well, because I actually did struggle with this one, and I narrowed it down to two that made me unbelievably uncomfortable with how dark they went here.
Right.
And I'm sure you can guess which two they are, because I brought them up before, but the one I ultimately went with is Wolf in the Fold.
I had that on my list of potentials, yeah.
You know, where we have, you know, Scotty accused of murdering a belly dancer, but really a sex worker.
Yeah.
You know, and so...
I don't even know that they hide the fact that there's sex workers in this area. It's,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was 60s TV, yes. But you can definitely read between the lines, because the lines are about as thick as a 2x4.
Yeah.
But so, and then you kind of find out that it's part of a space alien that's been killing sex workers for centuries.
Right.
And the way that they view women on this, and this is within the contemporary context of the 1960s, is so skin crawling to me. And it's just ultimately, I could not even believe that they were that out of sync with the era in which they're writing for a show that's supposedly so progressive. But I've never felt so uncomfortable watching a full hour of Star Trek. There is a scene in Enemy Within,
yeah,
in which we watch the, I guess, the evil version of Kirk attempt to rape Janice Rand for an extended period, just chasing her around, which I found absolutely horrifying to watch. But that was only, well, I think that scene was like 4 minutes long. But
right,
like,
yeah,
that was only 4 minutes. This was a full hour of watching Star Trek, and I've never felt so icky watching a full hour of a series like this.
And this episode was written by Robert Block, who wrote the book Psycho.
Yeah, what does that tell you, Cameron?
I always feel like he was a terrible fit for TOS, because he also wrote Cat's Paw, which isn't as problematic in terms of its content, but I just feel like his sensibilities do not match with Star Trek at all.
Cat's Paw wasn't really a strong episode either.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Wolf in the Fold also has this weird twist where, like, Scotty is now resentful to women.
Like, he gets hit in the head.
Yeah. And so,
this was, I was always confused, because he got hit in the head and they had to take him down to see a sex worker to cure him.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm like, what are you talking about? Like,
yeah.
And that was at the very beginning of the episode. Like, so anyway, sorry.
But by saying he gets hit on the head, now he's resentful of women, it's almost implying this sort of, it's taking the responsibility away from this character, even though Scotty's innocent. But nonetheless, it's taking the responsibility for these feelings away from him, being like, oh, well, he got hit on the head. It's like, okay, like, I don't understand. Like, what is going on with this character?
No, I don't want to speak for Robert Block, but there's definitely, if you look at Psycho, if you look at this, a certain thread about his views of women that I think is kind of revealing, because I have to believe that maybe he's using writing as a sort of therapy to a certain degree.
That, or he was very interested in approaching the subjects of, like...
No, but he can't be interested in approaching it and write something that's so egregiously harmful and poisonous. This does reflect, I think, his own psyche to a certain degree.
And I will say, Psycho, the book, is very different than the movie in terms of the internal monologue you're hearing from Norman Bates, which is the sort of stuff you see in Wolf in the Fold.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So this one, as much moral compromise as involves Scotty, I can't say that this justifies itself as an adventure that I believe would actually take place within this universe. I think this one fails.
It feels weird. It feels like a very weird episode that stands outside of the series in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So I can wrap my head around Cat's Paw. This one, I'm like, what?
I know. Cam, what's your next episode?
Okay, well, I'm going to maybe jump over to Voyager. I think we should maybe leave DS9 to last, considering there's the most entries that make sense, as well as the fact we opened with one. So let's jump over to Voyager. This one I struggled with actually a lot, because I think there's some really strong Voyager episodes, and maybe even episodes that I don't like as much, but are really heavy subject matter. So like one I really considered was a Retrospect, which is the episode where Seven of Nine is trying to prove that she was assaulted, which I found incredibly, incredibly depressing episode and heavy, heavy material.
And it doesn't really work well in the Me Too movement either.
Yeah, that episode has not aged well.
No. Well, I remember watching it at the time, and it was bad at the time.
Yeah. The episode I ended up going with is the episode Nothing Human, which, in case anyone doesn't remember, it's the episode where B'Elanna Torres has this space parasite on her side, which is... That alone is the most horrific thing I think I've ever seen in Star Trek. That really bothers me a lot.
Really?
But that's not the reason why I chose this episode.
Oh, yeah. You have a fear of leeches, don't you?
I do. A terrible one, yeah. But I say terrible like I'm plagued by this every day. But
you wake up with leeches all over your body.
I had, you know, there were some incidents at the summer cabin that I, But where this episode, I think, to me, really reaches a very dark level is when they bring in this holographic doctor, Dr. Krell Moset, who is basically a stand-in for Joseph Mengele from World War II, who performed horrific experiments on people, a lot of children, in the concentration camps. And this character, this Cardassian doctor, had experimented on people and cured a plague. And the doctor is embracing this character because of the knowledge he has. And the show sets up this conflict between a Bajoran crew member and this doctor, basically saying, like, you know, what this guy did is unthinkable. We should not be using him, despite the fact he may be the only hope B'Elanna has.
Right.
And I know this is an episode that gets a lot of flack from fans.
Because the doctor's attitude was like, hey, what's the big deal?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, I'm willing to give that one a bit of a break, though, because the doctor is a hologram. Like, if he is thinking logically like a computer, I'm willing to accept that more, even though it doesn't make the character particularly everyone's friend that week.
Right.
But ultimately, it you know, the episode ends with them, with the doctor erasing this character as well as all his work. And to me, this is the type of material that I'm actually kind of surprised Voyager went there. But I don't know that it gets darker than when you're inciting Dr. Mengele in your stories.
Do you recall, was this a Kenneth Biller script?
I can't recall.
Okay, no. Okay. Because I could, well, no, I was going to wonder if this is perhaps a Brian Fuller one as well, because it seems as if it could have been a Brian Fuller story too.
Right.
Yeah. This is actually, no, this is something that I do understand taking place within this universe, though. Like, you go to dark places in that holodeck there.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, and I remember at the time, this one really did make me feel uncomfortable watching it.
Yeah.
And it's funny that it was more of a Doctor episode than the B'Elanna episode I thought it was going to be going into it as well.
Right.
So, yeah, to me, where would you come down, Cam, if you were being infected by a space parasite? Would you go to the extremes to save yourself?
I'm a bad person to ask because of my fear of parasites. So if I have a giant parasite on my side, I might be like, finish the procedure and save my life and then delete it. But then maybe I'm a horrible person, so I don't know.
Maybe you're just being honest with
yourself. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, desperation, I may, you know, it's tough to say. And I think that's actually what this episode is good at, is bringing those questions into the minds of the viewers and asking, like, what would you do?
Yeah.
And I know it's an episode that's quite controversial, and a lot of people really, really hate it a lot. And so, I don't know, where did you stand on it?
I remember not hating it horribly. Mm-hmm. It wasn't one of my favorites, though.
Yeah, I would never say it's an episode that I'd be tuning into, you know, on my rewatches.
I mostly just remember it making me feel very uncomfortable throughout.
Yeah.
So I think good directing throughout this one. So you buy the dilemmas here.
Yeah.
You talked about, you know, what would you do in a situation? And I think I want to go to another episode on Star Trek Voyager, Tuvix, in which we have, you know, Neelix and Tuvok combined into one entity, who does not want to be redistributed back into two entities when the procedure presents itself after he's already integrated into the crew.
Yeah.
The doctor is not going to do this procedure, do no harm, so Janeway takes it upon herself to do this. And we have that scene on the bridge in which Tuvix is literally begging for his life.
Yeah.
And telling people, well, you're going to have to live with this. You're good people, but you've been compromised. Everybody kind of gives them a blank stare, though, which is unfortunate. But I think this is one of kind of the strongest Voyager outings for me, in that by the end, whether she acknowledges it later on or not, Janeway, I think, is compromised in this situation. She is going against the will of a sentient being in order to, I guess, provide life to two sentient beings. So the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few in this situation. But it is a very dark place for Janeway to go. And she goes to a lot of, like, very many dark places. I mean, Equinox is something worth
bringing actually thought
up.
You were going to bring Equinox into the discussion.
It was, but you know what? We see Tuvix very early on in Voyager's run, and I think that's one of the key differences here, in that Janeway isn't necessarily at her breaking point yet, as she is in, say, Equinox. So,
right.
Either way, you know that I like episodes with the letter X in them, Cam.
Of course. There's also the difference in that seeing Rudy Ransom compromise himself is very different than seeing Janeway. And Janeway really doesn't carry the weight of Tuvix that I feel like she should.
You throw the rest of the run in the series.
Yeah.
I'd say that goes for the rest of the crew as well. And I think this is one of the episodes that it doesn't quite elevate it into an all-time great. Because what does it essentially mean by the end of it? Especially when Tuvok and Neelix are both saying, "So glad you did that, Janeway. We didn't want to be that one entity anymore." So
right.
I was like, okay.
Yeah. This is such a weird episode in that, like, it's one that...
I know I like it far more than you do.
No, I actually like the episode. I think you elevate it higher than I do.
Sure.
But I did like it. I think it's interesting in that, you know, when you read behind the scenes and how much it seems like the actor playing Tuvix just was having a miserable time and could never get this character down and they were never happy with him. It is interesting that when I watch the show, I don't feel that.
Yeah.
And that Tuvix does work as a character. And he's at least more interesting than Tuvok. So... actually, he's more likable than Neelix.
Yeah,
so.
No, I like Tuvix more than either one of those characters, which is kind of the weird thing.
And I think the show actually does a really good job in making him a tragic character.
Mm-hmm.
I just question whether this was the story to tell on Voyager. Like, I wonder if this story would have worked better with, like, a Rudy Ransom crew, where you can kind of leave those characters behind instead of remembering Janeway for doing this. Like, this is a pretty heavy story to attach to your main character.
Well... Yeah, no, I agree
without
with
any
that.
Sort of long-term ramifications.
And I think that's the main problem there, is like, this doesn't haunt her the way that, say, Geordi's haunted by his romantic life, or Barclay by his professional mistakes.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so do you buy this as taking place within the context of this universe that's been established?
I think so, yeah.
What about Janeway's actions? Do you buy her this early on in the series run as going forward with this, or do you think it was perhaps mostly just a result of day-to-day, you know, 90s production of television?
I think it was probably more the latter.
Yeah.
And that they really didn't have to put any thought into how this would affect the character long-term.
Yeah.
Yeah. But nowadays, I think if they had an episode like this, it would carry on for a couple episodes. The memory of Tuvix would live on. Okay, well, let's jump over to Enterprise.
There are two that jumped out to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll wait for you to fill me in on your pick, and then if you pick one of mine, I'll do another one then.
Right. Okay. Well, I considered Similitude for reasons that relate to Tuvix, in that that's the clone of Trip that ended up.
That didn't quite make my list, but it was one of the ones that I jotted down in my notes.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I ended up going with Cogenitor.
Okay.
Which is the episode where these aliens come to visit the NX-01. And they have a third sex that is used for birthing, essentially, and has no rights, no identity. And Trip befriends this one and encourages them to pick a name, names themselves Charles. And Trip spends a lot of the episode, you know, trying to instill hope in this character, which is a very Star Trek thing, you know, like, things are going to get better for you. You can have an identity. You can be kind of like, kind of pave the way for others like you. And then this character is ultimately left hopeless with realizing there is no hope right now for them, and commits suicide.
Yeah.
And I really like this episode. Like, I know that sounds like a weird thing to say after that description, but what I like about it is it shows the types of ramifications not following the Prime Directive can have. And I know the Prime Directive doesn't quite exist at this point, but it shows how, you know, in the other series, they got off scot-free a lot of the time. They could make major changes to a planet, especially in the TOS era, and walk away being like, yep, I'm sure it all worked out. But I really like how this episode, takes a character like Trip Tucker, who's kind of the aw shucks, I'm here for an adventure type of guy, and just completely like shakes him to his core of like, you can't help people all the time. You know, you can't make major changes to the society because you think it's what should be.
And although they don't bring up, you know, this cogenitor again, I do feel as this is something that would haunt Trip.
Yeah.
Like this is a kind of character who would be deeply affected by something like this.
Yeah, and the episode ends with like Archer just tearing him to shreds in a way that
I remember that very vividly.
I remember watching that scene just being like, holy smokes.
I didn't know Scott Bakula could be this mean.
Yeah. Like I really am just so impressed by that scene still. Like how hard those actors go at it. And just how the episode ends and you're just like, holy smokes. Like, I feel like I've really seen something. You know, there's that episode of TNG. Was it The Outcast? Was it the one with the androgynous species?
And my brain went there as well when you brought up Cogenitor, just because I think this is a better run at what they're attempting to do here.
Yeah, like a lot of the time you see in Star Trek, they'll recycle a storyline from the past and maybe try to do it better. And I think this was a case where Enterprise actually did it better than TNG. I like the TNG episode a lot, but it doesn't have the sorts of, you know, believable horrors that could result from this sort of scenario.
Although I would say it is pretty horrifying to see how they had to go through, like, kind of brainwashing.
It is true, actually.
Essentially, that's what do they call it? Homosexual therapy or whatever.
Right, yeah.
It's just kind of like, oh, God. Yeah. Like, they still have this in the 24th century, guys.
Yeah.
But, yeah. No, Cogenitor, great one. I think it's easy to believe this happened within the universe that's set up because this is kind of pre-Federation. It's where you don't quite know the rules. And I think this is actually a good example of Enterprise living up to the promise of a series that would take place pre-Federation as you're figuring out the rules as you go along here. Mm-hmm.
An episode like this really underlines why the Prime Directive was necessary. And that's something Enterprise should have done more of.
Yeah.
Of having people make mistakes and how that impacts their mission going forward.
One of the ones with regards to making up the rules as you go along that I'll highlight here is a season 3 entry that really stood out to me. It featured the return of Casey Biggs as a captain of the ship in the episode Damage, in which they the NX-01 crew, no supplies left. They need this very critical supply. They're begging to do a trade with this Casey Biggs captain. He's like, sorry, I just can't do it for you. So they go steal this and just leave him adrift.
Yeah.
And the captain's like, I'm going to die out here. Like, my crew's going to die if you leave us like this. And Archer's like, sorry, like, we're going to die otherwise. And to me, it's that moral compromise that Archer deals with all throughout season 3. We've never seen Archer push to his breaking point so much in a single season than we did during the Zindi arc here. Damage is the one that really sticks out to me as a bit of a turning point for the character. And I think it also is a good showcase for Phlox, this is his most prominent season, where Phlox is really the one pushing back against the captain. I think the Denomulans have been
just like the actors, because John Billingsley was not as big a fan of the Zindi arc.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
He's said it before that he found a very jingoistic response to 9/11. Although he got a lot of great material to work with here.
Definitely.
But this is an example where you have the Denomulans who have been a spacefaring species for much longer than the humans. They've kind of been around the block, so to speak. And he does push back against Archer's actions here. And Archer, he seems affected by his decisions here more so than Ben did in the Pale Moonlight, which I do find interesting. But for Archer, he still carries forward. The criticism I have of this, though, is that we never really find out whatever happened to that alien. And I wish that came up, whether he lived and sought revenge, or if the crew died and Archer had to, instead of pushing it and compartmentalizing it in his head, he had to actually face up to it and deal with it again.
That's a really good example, actually. I was actually interested in that when I was doing research for this episode. I was going through the Zindi War episodes because it just seemed to me like, oh, there's going to be a lot of really prime candidates in that batch of episodes in season 3. I was actually surprised. It didn't seem like there was as heavy amount of episodes as like Deep Space Nine Dominion War arc. Like,
sure.
That really kind of got into like the really, really brutal moral stuff like Deep Space Nine did on Enterprise. I mean, you have the Archer throwing the guy in the airlock stuff, but it didn't feel like you had these episodes that were as grim as some of the other, you know, other series.
Yeah, I agree with that, even though it was a pretty... It was a heavy season.
It is a heavy season. Yeah. But you don't get these standalone episodes that feel as heavy as some of the ones we've discussed on this episode.
But I think the very fact that this takes place pre-Federation, it makes sense that Archer would do something like this, push to the brink, and then it would happen. But would you... I can't imagine Picard ever doing something like this. Like,
yeah.
I think Picard would be like, well, we'll find another way.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Kirk?
I think Kirk would have smooth-talked the alien somehow.
Right.
That's what Kirk's specialty was.
No, that's very true.
So,
man, we know Archer's not a smooth-talker.
No, that's true. Gazelles.
Water polo.
Okay, Cam, what's next on your list here?
Well, why don't we move into Discovery? Discovery is a whole batch of dark episodes, so it's kind of tough to nail down one specific one that stands out more than the rest.
CV Pacem Parabellum.
That running man. The episode I ended up choosing was The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry. And it's for, you're giving me a weird
really?
Look. Yes, and I think it has to do with the Ripper story.
Okay.
Of the abuse of this creature for the good of the Federation's war. And I think that to me is what made this, for me, the heaviest episode of the season. It's one that I took a lot away. Maybe I'm just more of an animal person and I look at Ripper as like an animal, so that sort of thing kind of bothers me more.
You really like this episode, which to me is one of my least favorites.
Yeah,
and I think it might be, well, maybe we'll open up a little bit of the doorway into Cam's life, but you are right now dealing with the recent death of a pet. Mm-hmm. And I think that certainly does like kind of affect your viewing experience as well for like a TV show, because you can kind of relate far more to, I guess, the pain and suffering that's going on there.
Yes, and I've put down a lot of animals in my day. Our house was always full of animals, so I'm definitely very, very familiar with having animals around. And so when I see films or TV where creatures essentially are being put through torment, it does bother me more than people, just in general. And this episode for me falls right in that arena where the Ripper story of this creature that is gentle and, you know, we see it communicating with Burnham and then being thrown into this machine for the good of the spore drive. And, you know, under the direction of Lorca, who we see is not a good guy.
No.
Even from the beginning. And, you know, Landry going to prod it. Like, to me, I don't know that it gets that much darker for me. And then you throw in, this is also the episode where we find out the Klingons ate Georgiou, and that's just like icing on the cake.
Yeah, that's pretty nasty.
You know, it just feels like altogether, this is a very grim, dark, heavy episode. And I think there's other episodes that we can, that maybe you'll call out, I don't know, that maybe are aesthetically, you know, throwing in stuff that's really ugly. But this one to me feels like it really does show it in a way that is hitting you on an emotional level as opposed to just a visceral level.
No, I buy that. I wonder, though, if this makes sense within the universe as it's been established, because this is only 10 years before Kirk, but it's still about 100 years into the Federation. I still have a tough time that they would be doing all this to the tardigrade, no matter the fact that this is a mirror universe captain.
Though. Right.
Like, what's Landry's excuse?
We've never been able to figure that out.
Yeah.
And although you could make the argument, does a lot of Discovery fit into the period of 10 years before Kirk?
I know, but then how exactly did Ripper get to be this way aboard the Glenn?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't you think that the crew of the sister ship would have had moral fortitude than one Gabriel Lorca?
Yeah. Maybe there'll be a prequel comic to explain that, too.
Can't wait, yeah. So, to me, this is one of the ones where I kind of waver about how much this really does fit into the context of the universe of Star Trek as we know it, though, because this was the one that, it made me feel uncomfortable watching the Ripper stuff, but it also made me wonder, well, would this actually happen on TNG? Like, could you have ever imagined the storyline taking place on TNG?
No.
I can't. So,
I mean, you could maybe point the parallel to Equinox in Voyager. That's maybe the closest parallel.
Mm-hmm.
But just the fact we're seeing a Federation. Well, I mean, it was there, I guess, Rudy Ransom as well. But the Starfleet people in the Discovery episode are not under the grueling conditions that the Equinox was.
Right. Okay. Well, with regards to Discovery, may not shock you. You know, we go from one dark episode that's low on my rankings. We'll go to another. I've got Vaulting Ambition here.
Yeah, I knew you were going to highlight this one.
And it's not because of the Lorca twist, which I've complained about before, sure. But there's a lot going on in this one. I've never seen Star Trek so capricious before. And the one moment that really stuck out to me is in which Georgiou finds out that Burnham is from the Prime Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so she executes everybody with the fidget spinner from hell.
Right.
And there's like the sense that, and this is more of an execution thing. It's funny because most of my picks have been going from like internal conflict that characters are dealing with, but this is more of an execution thing. And I don't mean execution of characters, but the way that the filmmakers did this, in that they seem to be celebrating the violence and like, hey, let's see how cool we can make it. And my entire experience in the USS Karin was, I felt unbelievably uncomfortable throughout. I think they wanted you to, but it was a weird mix of the producers wanting to celebrate this bad universe, but also wanting to condemn the actions going on here. And so this capriciousness that went throughout, whether you have those torture chambers that Lorca is exposed to and what he also puts other people through, it's just like, I had enough
right
of this universe. And it didn't really help with the Lorca twist either as well. And then also finding out that Lorca had groomed a young Burnham,
yeah,
you know, with all the sexual connotations associated with that. That was,
right,
like, revolting, mm-hmm, in my opinion, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this one, the grooming stuff aside, like, a lot of it I can look at as sort of this very, very, very black-humored camp. And that a lot of it is just, it's the sort of thing I would see in a lot of very twisted, like, black-humored horror films. You know, especially with, like, the eating Kelpians, the way Georgiou just, you know, kills all her staff. Like, I've seen this sort of thing before.
That made me want to puke as well.
It's the sort of thing that I have, I mean, I don't know, I have more of a twisted sense of humor, maybe, but I kind of smiled at, I was amused by it.
I can be amused by it, like, with the memes that were created out of it, but at the moment, we're literally watching these Kelpians pushed out and then picked for
food. That is true, that is
like,
true.
That wasn't funny. Like,
that
wasn't meant
that part
to be a joke either. And like,
I would say the part where she's giving it to Burnham, that's the kind of the sick humor part. But yes, the scene where they're pushing the Kelpians out, yeah, that's not so funny.
Yeah.
I think the joke is more of like that she thinks they're being sent to be servants. And then you see what happened to it. That's the dark joke of it. And, you know, we can have the argument of whether that's funny or not, but that's what the show's going for, is a very, very, very dark joke.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate what they're going for, and I can say that I've seen things in other movies that would have definitely kind of amused me more, and I think that has to do with more execution. And I'm thinking stuff like Texas Chainsaw Massacre 1 and 2, like that sort of stuff, which are definitely kind of embracing horror camp in a way that I think this episode is trying to. When I get into the stuff like the Georgiou killing her staff, it's done so badly that it has no impact on me, really. It's, mm-hmm, the sort of thing I've seen a billion villains do, and I just, like, roll my eyes because it's done so badly on that episode.
My problem, though, is if we constantly see deaths like this,
yeah,
then it adds up to nothing. Then there's no stakes going on. If death doesn't matter, if violence isn't gut-wrenching,
yeah,
then what does anything really matter? Like, why are we invested in this universe here if it's all just pretty much like a video game?
Right. You know, well, and I think that is a problem in that the way Discovery chose to tackle the Mirror Universe is to amp up the horror and the death in a way that I think takes away from the fun of what people like about the Mirror Universe. Like, I don't think when they're watching the DS9, some of the better DS9 ones, or Mirror Mirror, or Into a Mirror Darkly on Enterprise, that they're walking away being like, man, that was disgusting.
Right.
You know, there is an aspect of just having fun with it and having characters fighting with their, you know, doubles and that sort of thing. Whereas you get to Discovery, they're not doing that.
I didn't have fun in this universe. Like, I couldn't wait to get out of it because it just seemed like such a treacherous, horrible place to be, which I think that's actually what the producers wanted.
I would say so, yeah.
But then why would I want to spend 4 hours in there?
You know, it's interesting in that I could totally see...
Four episodes.
Yeah, four episodes. Yeah. I could totally see a lot of the really, really dark material in Vaulting Ambition coming from Brandon Braga, because I know he is a dyed-in-the-wool horror guy. Mm-hmm. And you see elements of that in, like, Threshold, where you have, like, Tom Paris's tongue, like, falling out and stuff like that. Like, really gross horror. And I could see him doing that sort of stuff. And I think it's just the execution of it isn't very good.
Yeah.
And it feels too at odds with what the franchise is.
I agree. And it feels too at odds with what the previous Mirror Universe outings had kind of established. And I just walked away feeling from this episode. There's so many bad things going on in this episode. Although, if you look at IMDb, the user scores is...
Yeah, it's near the top.
I think it might be the top episode. And it's... I think it's my bottom episode.
Yeah.
So what do I know? I'm sure we can get more angry letters from
people. And you know that I didn't rank this episode high at all.
No.
I think
no.
it was my worst too. Yeah. So, but I can I guess appreciate that they were trying to do something outside the... Like, Star Trek is all about genre hopping, right? And I kind of appreciate them going for like very, very black horror type stuff. I just don't think it was particularly satisfying to throw it into this arc of a season about essentially Starfleet rediscovering what it means to be Starfleet is really weird.
Yeah.
So.
Alrighty, sir. Why don't we go into the big kahuna here? Let's tackle Deep Space Nine. Too many episodes to really choose from, but I guess we've narrowed it down, Cam. I'll throw it to you first.
Okay. Well, I thought about a few here because Lord knows DS9 offers no few. And I watched one actually the other night, The Quickening, which is the plague. Oh, yeah. That episode, it's not my pick. That episode may be the episode of Deep Space Nine I never want to watch again in my life. In that, anytime I'm watching people get really ill on screen for a prolonged period, I do not like sitting through it.
No, I find it boring, like television. It's not dramatic.
For me, it's not boring. I find it makes me actually feel sick.
It's not dramatically interesting at all. It's like, wow, there's somebody who's incapacitated. It takes away their agency within a drama. So I'm just kind of like, anyways, okay, go on.
Yeah, but, and I considered some of the episodes that were sort of flashbacks to Tarek Nor events, which were very awful, Necessary Evil or Things Past. But I actually ended up going with one that is kind of the same thing, which is Wrongs Darker Than Death or Night.
Hmm.
I don't know that there's a darker hour of Star Trek, period.
This, of course, is with Kira discovering that her mother was essentially...
A kept woman.
A kept woman for Dukat.
Yes.
And Dukat made the effort to announce this to Kira on a view screen on her mother's birthday, which is pretty disgusting. Yeah. If we ever thought Dukat could be as lecherous and odious of a character, they amp it up even more.
Yes. And to just see this episode, which is really great, like I genuinely think it's a great hour of television, in that we are shown Kira's mom, who could easily be like a player of the week type character, and the shades of gray they give this character, and as well as Kira's feelings towards her, are so rich, and that you walk away with this sense of tragedy, not just for Kira, but also for her mother and the whole family. And Kira has this, relationship where she doesn't know what to even make of her mom at the end, because her mom was this kept woman who was living in luxury. We know that her end was very grim, dying in a hospital, but other people were dying for horrible things while she was living in luxury with Dukat. But at the same time, she was also saving her family doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so this episode raises so many questions.
But that's what DS9 does so well, though, and I think that's great.
But this might be the most depressing hour of Star Trek I've ever watched.
It was incredibly uncomfortable.
Yes.
Yeah, and just even the scenes where the family's being torn apart from each other.
Yeah.
And that, you also feel like there is no hope, because remember those Bajoran thugs who, they're threatening the safety of this family if they don't give up, their meager rations?
Yeah.
And you feel it as if, the Kira family is at the end of their rope here. Like, what else can they do going forward?
Yeah.
Yeah. This made it as one of my possible picks here.
Right.
And I guess I'm going with something that is a little bit of a flashier episode, but it goes back to, and I keep going back to moral compromise on the parts of the characters about what makes Star Trek dark. And so, believe me, there's a number of Kira episodes that I was just like, I could do Darkness and the Light, in which she falls victim nearly to that surgeon who's going to pull her Kiriyoshi from her body, yeah. which is like disturbing. But
you've got like Duet in season one.
Yeah.
Anything to do with like the Holocaust or World War II, like that's when Star Trek can get really dark. I guess a lot of my picks probably touch on that.
Yeah. There's another one, like CJET AR-558, where I think Quark has a fantastic scene in which he explains to Nog, you take away all these creature comforts that humans are so used to, they turn into vicious animals. And that's what we're seeing come out right now. Mm-hmm. Nog ends up losing his leg from this. But to me, the one that I ended up settling on is, again, I go back to Ben Sisko and what he did in For the Uniform when he goes up against Eddington.
Yeah.
And
I actually watched this episode yesterday.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Okay. But again, this is a Maquis leader here. Mm. And he says, well, you know what? If he thinks that... he's the hero in Les Miserables, then I'll just be the villain here, and I'll prove it. So I'm going to poison an entire planet with torpedoes.
A classic Picard maneuver.
Exactly. Well, you saw the look that Worf gave Sisko, and Sisko's like, I'm not kidding. Fire. Everybody aboard the bridge is going, what the hell? Like, this is something where Sisko is just saying, no, I'm going to be the villain if that's how he wants to view me.
It's interesting that last week we talked in our crossover episode about Flashback, which has Tuvok standing up to Sulu over going to save Kirk. No one stands up to Sisko to stop him from like bombing this Maquis settlement.
What do you think Tuvok would have done had he been stationed?
He would have had an aneurysm if he'd seen this.
Would he have staged a mutiny?
Do you see Tuvok as someone who would stage a mutiny?
It's such a weird situation, though, because aren't you... We see all the shit that Sisko pulls, right? Yeah. And I think In the Pale Moonlight is one of those touchstone episodes, but I think this is actually one of the clear signs. Like, he literally poisons an entire planet's ecosystem. I think they say that it won't be inhabitable for decades. These are people he displaces, I believe, hundreds, maybe even thousands of settlers, that women, children, men,
right?
Too. So it's like this is a villainous act on his part, and is it because they're at the verge of losing a galactic war?
Right.
No, it's because he wants to catch the crook.
Are you surprised in retrospect that the writers didn't have the crew stand up to him or cause more of an argument?
Yes, I am, because DS9 was all about conflict,
right?
But then how do you make the character look as if he has agency if we don't have more conflict going on, or no, if we have continued conflict going on for an action we know ultimately Sisko's going to follow through with? He's going to say to Worf, well, if you don't push the button, I'm going to push the button instead,
right?
So and then you're like, well, where do the characters go from there moving forward? So to me, I mean, this doesn't stand out as like as uncomfortable to watch as Wrongs Darker Than Death or Night.
What are you talking about?
Which
there's nothing darker than that episode.
It might be the most uncomfortable like DS9 episode.
Other than Prophet and Lace.
Other than Prophet and Lace. But this one to me, it's like, wow, Sisko had shades of this moral elasticity that we did not necessarily see with Picard that I think is very notable here.
Can you see any of the other captains doing that?
Maybe Janeway.
And Lorca.
And, well, actually, yeah. 100% Lorca. Maybe Janeway, but probably not Janeway.
Yeah.
But that's the next closest other than Lorca, of course.
Right.
I don't think Lorca would have any issue with that.
I'm surprised they should go back and digitally do a special edition where he's like, do the Lorca maneuver. Just bomb the planet.
That'd be great. Yeah. Okay. So, Cam, are there any episodes that we didn't get to touch on that you just kind of want to name check here?
Yeah, there is another DS9 one that I feel we have to mention, and that is Hard Time.
Oh, right.
And that, okay, I watched this episode not too long ago, and this is the episode where Miles O'Brien winds up in a prison on this alien planet, and the prison is only in his mind. They've essentially injected memories into him that he's been, you know, in prison for how many years is it?
I think it's like 40 years.
Yeah, something, yeah. And we see him coming out of it and trying to readjust back to life on the station, and he can't. He's like lashing out at Molly because she wants him to like color or something like that. Now, the show doesn't really show him going to hit her, but then he says later that he was going to hit her. So I guess that's just how he felt at the point. At that point, it's not like he raised his hand in the scene, I should say.
Yeah.
But
I don't think the actress would have ever been coming back afterwards.
Yeah, no kidding. But we see, you know, later in the episode, it drives him to near suicide, where he's standing in the Hargo Bay with a phaser to his head.
Yeah.
And I was watching this episode, and it is a great episode. Cole Meany is just doing a fantastic job, as is Craig Wasson as his cellmate of Body Double fame, for the De Palma fans out there. But I had to laugh at a certain point just to how miserable this got for O'Brien. Like, I began to chuckle when it was just him, like, ripping up the cargo bay. I was like, oh my god, they have just, like, taken this character through the ultimate, you know, like, there's nothing worse than this for O'Brien.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, how did you feel about this one?
No, this one horrified me at the time. But then we got deeper into Deep Space Nine, and you're like, okay, well, we can go to very dark places here. But at the time, to me, what really stood out, though, is the very thought that within a split second, you could have all these memories implanted into your brain, and you believe that they're real. And that, I think that's quite the enduring punishment. But the whole point is that this simulation would not end until O'Brien had killed his cellmate here.
Yeah.
Until they made sure that he had been compromised.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of you can tell I keep on bringing up the word compromise throughout this, and that's really what draws me into Star Trek being dark.
Right. So did you have any others that stood out?
Yeah, well, let's give a Voyager example here, but Course Oblivion, in which we watched these, we didn't really know that they were from this demon planet at the time, but they're exact copies of the Voyager crew.
I was so excited for that wedding.
Were you?
When I was watching that episode, I was like, oh, that's nice.
Okay. I think my problem was I had actually read spoilers ahead of time, so I knew what the twist was.
Right.
But essentially, for those who...
I should have figured it out from the title.
For those who don't remember, these are copies of the Voyager crew, but they don't realize that they're copies. So we see them just withering away and slowly, slowly die.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really end well. They don't ever solve the problem, and it's kind of a forgotten about one-off journey. But this is a very depressing... a Brian Fuller script that, you know, ends with pure misery for these copies that we've been following for the entire 45 minutes. And I think we do get Voyager crew, like, brush by them at the very end of the episode and be like, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. See ya. It's interesting in that this is a spinoff of the episode Demons, which is such a lousy episode.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to me. They took a pretty bad, and I don't think anyone on the writing staff thought Demons was a good episode. But it still inspired them to write a really good follow-up episode.
It's such a Brian Fuller thing where he just likes doing... like, think about when he penned Kes's return for Fury, and he has this plot in which she's going to give the Voyager crew to the Vidians so that their organs can be harvested. That is such a Brian Fuller sort of thing to do.
How did the Vidians not make our list of the darkest?
That's true, yeah.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll have a video up this week, as well as all of the usual discussion. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We are going to go back to our two-part reviews. We're going to be tackling Favor the Bold and Sacrifice of Angels from Deep Space Nine. This should be a fun one.
Okay. So you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vidians. Not on my list, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's Reporton. N as in not compromised.
Okay.
N as in the pale moonlight.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.